the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, August 6, 2007, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
A look at Japan's parliamentary elections. Afghanistan continues to deteriorate, and the LAPD decides to train cameras on itself. Plus this week's Empire Notes.
When the fellow medal's out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. An opposition party member will be named the leader of Japan's upper house of parliament for the first time in a special session tomorrow. The appointment will follow the shift in Japan's political landscape following recent parliamentary elections on July 29th. Reigning Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and his Liberal Democrat Party faced one of their worst political setbacks, as the Democratic Party of Japan now dominates the upper house. Despite plunging approval ratings, Prime Minister Abe and his ruling coalition continue to enjoy a political advantage in the parliament's more powerful lower house. Nevertheless, the outcome of the elections may affect both Japan's domestic and foreign policy agendas. The Democratic Party of Japan may redefine Japan's support of Washington's foreign policy objectives, if only slightly. The opposition party has pronounced its desire to reorient its international policies through the United Nations. The Democratic Party of Japan has also pledged to oppose the extension of the nation's support of coalition forces in Afghanistan, which expires this November. A proposed free trade agreement with Australia, which is unpopular in Japan's rural sectors, now faces greater opposition in Parliament. Joining me on the line this morning is Miho Kim. She's an information activist at the Oakland-based research support organization. She's also the U.S. coordinator of the Tokyo Bay Area-based organization's Trans-Pacific Research and Action Institute for the Hisebitsu Nikkei. Welcome to Uprising, Miho.
Thank you.
So why is Shinzo Abe's popularity been waning? What are the main reasons that the Japanese population is a little bit disillusioned with him?
Well, I think the overwhelming reason, I'm sure many factors, but recently there was a huge scandal surrounding the missing 5 million records of state pensions. And that was intended for, you know, folks in their old age to be available. And yet, because of the missing records, that is no longer a certainty. Now, a lot of the voting constituencies, throughout the country, basically, you know, use that as really a destabilizing factor for their future, when state pension already didn't look good in light of the aging population. And I think given that, you know, since Abe came on to his premiership, there were four ministerial resignations, well, actually three, with one being a suicide. They were mostly associated with the corruption or allegation of corruption, misuse of political funds. All of those things, I think, really destabilized and sort of helped to delegitimate some of the reassuring words that, you know, the Liberal Democratic Party, to which Abe belonged, had for the people.
What are some of the policy differences between Abe's Liberal Democratic Party and the Democratic Party of Japan, which, as I mentioned, now dominates the upper house?
You know, it's an interesting question. It's the one that I'm still trying to figure out, actually. And according to a lot of my colleagues in Japan as well, I think the main feeling is that basically the platform of the Democratic Party of Japan was that it was not the LDP. So we understand that it's not the LDP, so what is it going to be? It sounds almost as if the Democratic Party of Japan is more pro-peace than the Liberal Democratic Party, mainly because, as you mentioned, the special anti-terrorism law, which was one of the key legislations that were passed post 9/11 to support the Allied coalition, you know, and the U.S.-led efforts in the Middle East. Well, that's going to expire in November. The LDP is wanting to have that renewed, while the Democratic Party of Japan is saying, let's pump the brakes right here. But that's not necessarily coming from a pro-peace stance, I must say. For example, the party's head, Ozawa, has been one of the vocal proponents of revision of the Article 9 of the Constitution. And the Article 9 is the article that prohibits Japan from resorting to use of military violence and makes Japan renounce the right to belligerency. And if you take the Article 9 away, then Japan can officially conduct war, and it hasn't had the ability to do so. And so the country has sort of been bound by this particular Article 9 of the Constitution to really become the pro-warring politicians' words, a full-fledged sovereign nation. Because in order to be a sovereign nation, not only do you have to have the right to defend itself, but you have to have the right to aggression.
And this is a legacy of World War II we're talking about.
Absolutely,
here.
Yes.
And so changing this around and really turning Japan into a quote-unquote useful ally for the United States, in terms of foreign policy at least, you're saying, seems to be one of the main differences between these two parties.
I'm sorry, repeat that?
So this sort of aspect of changing Japan's foreign policy formally seems to be a main difference between these two parties. Depending upon who really manages to take more power, we might see Japan as a more active participant with the U.S. Or not. Is that, would you say that that's true?
I think it's a matter of the degree to which Japan would be forthcoming to assist the United States in its various foreign missions. Particularly of concern, I think, is the security cooperation, as it typically has been, I think, for the United States. And I know that the ambassador to Japan from the U.S., his name is Schieffer, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, he is about to meet Ozawa, the party head, on Wednesday, I believe, and it is widely suspected, if not confirmed, that the ambassador is going to try to take the route of direct convincing so that Ozawa, on behalf of the Democratic Party of Japan, would accept the position of accepting the renewal of the law, anti-special terrorism law.
What are the chances that Ozawa, the head of the Democratic Party of Japan, could be the next prime minister? I understand that Shinzo Abe has essentially refused to step down, even despite calls from his own party to do so.
Mm-hmm. I think some people feel that it's high, but honestly, that is something that is really difficult to project. And I think it's important to say that the Democratic Party of Japan, as I mentioned earlier, doesn't seem to have much of a substantive difference in terms of their basic principles as compared to the Liberal Democratic Party. For example, the Democratic Party of Japan, although some of the party members are very vocal about the Japan's, you know, world-known anti-nuclear stance and the three basic non-nuclear principles, you know, one, not to possess, secondly, not to ever produce, and three, not to allow the introduction of nuclear weapons in Japan, at the same time have not spoken up about the very fact that in U.S. bases in Japan, nuclear vessels are present. And so these, you know, the three basic principles are being kept alive, with the exception of the U.S. bases in Japanese territory. And so there are a lot of these contradictions that's been very consistent. And the other thing is that, California Congressman Mike Honda co-sponsored the House Resolution 121 that recently passed the Congress. And that resolution was calling to Japan to formally acknowledge and apologize as well as and accept historical responsibilities in a clear and unequivocal manner for the sufferings of the so-called comfort women.
Hmm.
The women, mostly from throughout Asia Pacific, who were made into sexual slaves, essentially, against their will under Japanese colonization or occupation. And the Democratic Party of Japan, a lot of the members from that party, I should say, along with many, many members of the Liberal Democratic Party, have actually signed on to various advertisements that appeared in newspapers in the United States as well, saying that, you know, that was a very unfortunate thing. And so there's not a lot of difference in the stance that we're seeing between the two parties in terms of key issues that really affect marginalized peoples and that affect also the historically impacted peoples by Japan's pro-war stance, as well as U.S.-Japan security collaboration.
So you're saying that there were several members of both parties that signed on to statements in U.S. newspapers supporting an acknowledgement of what happened to comfort women?
Acknowledging to the comfort women issue? What I meant was opposing the House resolution.
Oh, opposing, I see. So they're basically standing against it.
Exactly.
Hmm.
And so let's touch
upon some other local issues, some rather domestic issues happening inside Japan. You mentioned that, as you said, that their policies are not so different. I understand that there has been a lot of repression of teachers in Japan recently. What is this situation all about, and how do these two parties differ on that, if at all?
Well, 2003 was a time, and I'm going to use Tokyo as a prime sort of a case in this. There are 1,500 public school teachers throughout Japan right now that are punished in one way or another for refusing to sing the national anthem, which whose lyrics basically translates to his eternal reign to the emperor, as well as pledging allegiance to the flag. And in Tokyo, the Metropolitan Board of Education issued a directive to all of its schools in its jurisdiction in late 2003, saying that for all the teachers to do that at every ceremony for which it was called was an absolute mandatory thing. And one reason was to set an example for the children so that they, in their whatever age in the school systems, begin to learn to honor and respect the emperor through singing the flag, and to be willingly devoted to whatever was symbolized by the national flag. And other school systems followed suit, wherein the Board of Education really stepped in. And this was unprecedented. However, it has a legal framework. There was a education fundamental law passed through which the Board of Education feels more empowered to be able to tell the teachers, you know, whether to, participate in the ceremony or not fully. Now, the significance, I think, is that, one, the national anthem is basically singing for the eternal reign of the emperor. And we know when the emperor was in power, that was during the World War II, Hirohito led the whole nation. And the Japanese people had no choice but to have to obey the emperor. And so the obedience is what is being called for.
Hmm.
And the national flag really stood for the imperial ideology, which is likened in Japan to the Nazism and what the swastika stood for. And in fact, swastika and the national flag of Japan, the rising sun flag, was used side by side. And Japanese ideology, the imperial ideology, says that, you know, the Yamato people are the superior race, and that remains to this day as the ideological background against which structural apartheid against descendants of Korean colonial subjects of Japan, in Japan born and raised today, a third or fourth generation third or fourth generations are subject, as well as the justification for the structural inequity seen between Okinawa, which was before a sovereign separate nation, with the mainland Japan.
So this repression of teachers is in reaction to what's basically a political position that these teachers are taking.
It's a very much a political position, and it's a very politically sensitive thing as well. And I think it has a huge impact in terms of Japan and the Japan and its relations with the rest of Asia Pacific, because of unresolved issues such as only one of many being the so-called comfort women issue.
And very briefly, Miho, does the Democratic Party of Japan, which now has more votes in the upper house, does it acknowledge the repression of the teachers? Does it take any position on it?
You know, unfortunately, I believe none of the two main parties, which is the LDP and the Democratic Party, have really taken an explicit stance on it. And the sad reality is the Japan Teachers Union, which sort of is the national level that consolidates, you know, all the teachers unions in the municipality levels, have also turned a blind eye. And the interesting thing is the strong repression against public school teachers simply in their choice not to participate in the rituals were, you know, tied with Japan dispatching its navy for the first time since the end of World War II to Iraq, meaning where active invasion was occurring, for Japan's navy to be present has never, ever been the case before. And many people in Japan actually protested, saying this is a violation of our constitution, which prohibits Japan's participation in war.
Right.
Because war is, you know, denounced as a legitimate means of conflict resolution.
Right. Well, Miho, unfortunately, we are out of time right now. And, of course, there's much to talk about. We'll certainly continue to try to follow this story. Miho Kim is an information activist at the Oakland-based Research Support Organization, and she's also the U.S. coordinator of the Tokyo Bay Area-based organization Trans-Pacific Research and Action Institute for the Hisabetsu Nikkei. Miho, is there any contact information that you'd like to give out, particularly of your organization, the Trans-Pacific Research and Action Institute?
Sure. The website is currently under construction, but if you can email at info@hisabetsunikkei.org, and I'll spell that out in a minute, then I would love to provide more information, particularly about the campaign to express solidarity for some of the teachers who are in line to be fired next time the ceremony occurs and they protest the ritual one more time. And so they are calling for international solidarity on that, so I would love to get emails asking for information on that, and as well as other information, and that's info@hisabetsu, that's Hisabetsu, and then Nikkei, Nikkei, that's all one word, .org.
And we'll link to that from our website as well later today. Miho Kim, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Great, thanks for having me.
Again, the email is info@hisabetsunikkei.org. If you check Uprising's website later today, which can be found through kpfk.org, you can find that email address as well. You are listening to Uprising, and later in the hour, we will hear about LAPD's new plans to train cameras on itself. Also, this week's Empire Notes, and after this radical day in history, we'll find out why the Afghan president says his country is continuing to deteriorate. Stay tuned.
Tune in every Monday night at 7 p.m. to hear I Am RU, the nation's longest-running lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender news magazine.
2004, when the California Supreme Court ordered the San Francisco marriages halted, over 4,000 couples had been wed.
How does someone know if they're bisexual? What's the coming out process like?
Coming on the heels of a 6-0 decision by the California Supreme Court last Monday that a lesbian couple had been illegally denied full couple membership.
That's I Am RU every Monday night at 7 p.m.
This is your radio reporter, Hannah George. On this day, August 6th in 1945, during World War II, the U.S. dropped the atomic bomb, Little Boy, on the Japanese city of Hiroshima, making it the first city in history to be hit by a nuclear weapon. An estimated 140,000 people died because of the blast and the resulting radiation exposure, almost all of whom were civilians. U.S. President Truman ordered the bombings after the Japanese government declined the terms of surrender that the U.S., China, and Britain had put forth the previous month, with the intention of forcing Japan to surrender through widespread destruction and intimidation. The atomic bombings of both Hiroshima and Nagasaki are the only actual instances where nuclear weapons have been used in a war. Talk about large-scale terrorism. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past.
Welcome back to Uprising. In an interview this weekend with Wolf Blitzer, Afghan President Hamid Karzai was pessimistic about his country's future. He asserted that the security situation has, quote, definitely deteriorated over the last 2 years, and that U.S. and Afghan forces are no closer to capturing bin Laden. Karzai is about to begin a visit with President Bush in the United States. Bush has increased the number of troops to Afghanistan this year, saying that he anticipated a spring offensive by the Taliban. The Taliban has been holding 21 South Koreans hostage since last month and have already executed 2 of them. According to a Taliban spokesperson, the fate of the Koreans rests with Karzai and Bush. Meanwhile, the U.S. military said it had carried out a precision airstrike on Thursday against 2 Taliban commanders after ensuring there were no innocent Afghans in the surrounding area. As has commonly been the case in Afghanistan, local accounts of the raid were radically different, saying that there had been heavy civilian casualties. More than 6,500 people have been killed by U.S. NATO forces and Taliban fighters in the past 18 months, which makes it the bloodiest period since the fall of the Taliban in 2001. Joining me on the line this morning is Orbal. She is a member of the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. She's currently visiting the United States. Welcome to Uprising, Orbal.
Oh, hi there.
Thanks very much for joining us. Now, do you agree with President Karzai's assessment that the country is deteriorating very rapidly? And why do you think he is saying these things to the United States right now?
I think I absolutely agree with what Karzai has said. And as before, what Rawa used to say to everyone, that Karzai is in the government, and if he compromises with the warlords in the government right now, the situation will get worse. But what the world used to accuse us of was to Rawa is being very pessimistic towards the situation, whereas this was not the truth, and we were giving reports of the bad situation in Afghanistan, but no one was paying attention to us. And then right now, and they were again and again telling this to everyone that Afghanistan has been a very peaceful country and a very free country and, you know, showing a very sugar-coated Afghanistan in media and on TV and on radios and all. Whereas right now, he himself is saying that there's a lot of insecurity. And it's increasing day by day.
So you're attributing the insecurity to his compromise with the warlords, members of the Northern Alliance who are now dominating parliament. Yet in the news, all we hear about is the Taliban.
Yes. And Taliban is not a very serious matter in Afghanistan. When we say Taliban, it's just a group of most barbaric and most misogynist people. They're not very powerful, and it's not very difficult to get rid of them.
How would one get rid of them?
I'm sorry, pardon?
How would one actually get rid of them? You said it's not very difficult. So what could Afghanistan do?
With the modern equipment, with the modern weapons that America has, and the other countries that are involved in Afghanistan, it's not very difficult to get rid of them. And as I said, that what America is doing is it's looking for anti-American terrorists and not pro-American terrorists. Right now, the parliament and the cabinet is full of terrorists. They should more see to what's happening there. They're supporting them. And they are a much more threat for our people than Taliban. Taliban are not so serious as these warlords are. And our people have already suffered under them from 92 and 96 of the heinous crimes that they have committed in Afghanistan and of the terrible situation that Afghanistan went through with only 65,000 civilians dead only in Kabul.
What are the main crimes of the warlords currently? Certainly they, as you mentioned, have had a lot of, have committed a lot of crimes against the Afghan people in the early 1990s. But since they've been in power in the parliament, what kind of crimes have they committed against the Afghan people?
Okay. They have raped women. They have kidnapped women. The warlord who is right now the Minister of Water and Electricity in Afghanistan, he used to be in power in Herat. He used to pick up girls and check them for chastity. This was the situation. And the crimes that they have, the raping of young girls and women is increasing day by day. And this is a story about Sanobar. She was a 9-year-old girl who was raped by these Northern Alliance gunmen who are right now in power. But she was gang-raped, and then she was later traded for a dog. Then there's Amina, that after the fall of Taliban, she was accused of having an affair, and she was stoned to death. This was when these warlords and these drug lords were in power. There are many, many more crimes that are committed on a daily basis.
So would you say that the warlords are essentially targeting the domestic population, whereas the Taliban, with their kidnapping of South Koreans, is more of a problem for the international community, which is why they're getting so much attention?
Yes. And I believe that the casualty that what Afghanistan is going through right now, especially the women and children, it's a more serious problem than Taliban. And I don't say that South Korean hostages is not a problem, but they should consider this situation of Afghanistan a much serious one, because people are starving in Afghanistan. There's no education for women and girls. Insecurity is increasing day by day. Suicide bombings everywhere. Civilian casualties everywhere. Schools, young girls do not feel safe in going to school because they get kidnapped or get killed on the way.
Now, aren't the suicide bombings something that are a Taliban tactic?
They are. Why have Taliban become so powerful? Because right now their brothers with the same nature and with the same thinking is right now in the government, and they're becoming so powerful in terms of the opium cultivation and all. It's the reason is that the warlords and the criminals in the power are something like that.
So is there cooperation between the warlords in parliament and the Taliban on the ground, or are they opposing forces? Because before 2001, these were two opposite forces that were fighting one another.
They have the same nature. Either they're hungry for power. Either if it's Taliban or it's Northern Alliance, they have the same nature. They're against the women and children of Afghanistan. They're against Afghanistan being a very peaceful country, and it's not that either one of them is better. It's just that they have the same nature, and it makes no difference if it's Taliban or if it's the warlords or the Northern Alliance. So right now, the Northern Alliance is in power, and if Taliban would be in power, the same would have happened.
I'm speaking with a member of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. Her name is Orbal, and she is currently visiting the United States briefly. Now, you mentioned the issue of opium, and this weekend the Associated Press put out a report saying that Afghanistan will produce another record poppy harvest this year that essentially cements its status as the world's near sole supplier of the heroin source. Yet there's a furious debate over how to reverse the trend. Can you comment on this, on the opium production, and what you as an Afghan thinks needs to be done about it? The United States, of course, is paying lip service to poppy eradication, but what do you think should be done about opium production?
In the parliament, in the government, in general, drug lords are present. There's a ministry known as Against the Drugs and known as Against this Opium Cultivation and all, which is receiving billions of dollars every year in against these drugs. But we don't see any difference. Now, Afghanistan has become the topmost opium producer, and one of the generals said that it produces, an American general said that Afghanistan produces 95% of the opium in the world. So, and when someone like this, when the ministry who's fighting against this is involved in drug trafficking, how can you think of getting rid of drug law, the drugs and opium cultivation?
So does Hamid Karzai have power over this ministry?
Yes, but what Karzai is doing, Karzai is doing nothing in Afghanistan. Since the year that he's been in the government, he has compromised with these warlords and with these drug lords, and that's one of the reasons that they have become they have become so powerful, and they're backed by Karzai. And if Karzai and he's again and again, it's the people of Afghanistan think of it as a treason of Karzai compromising with them. And again and again, he has made our people very hopeless. Again and again, he's compromising with these warlords and drug lords.
Finally, Orbal, I want to just spend the last few minutes on a question following up from what we mentioned earlier. You said that the Taliban were not a very big problem and that if the United States wanted to, with modern weapons, could actually get rid of them. Well, the U.S. is saying that it is bombing the Taliban and it is claiming to kill Taliban, but the U.S. is also killing a lot of civilians, a lot of Afghan civilians. In fact, this year, I believe more Afghan civilians were killed by U.S. and NATO forces than even the Taliban. So what do you say about that, and what is your opinion on the U.S. and NATO occupation of Afghanistan?
I think if they really think about, if they really want to get rid of them, want to get rid of Taliban, it's, as I said, it's not very difficult. But what they're doing, they're bombarding their civilian casualties, and for the past years that they have been in Afghanistan, there have been 13,000 civilian deaths, and I think that it's not very difficult. What America should do is get rid of Northern Alliance just right now. They are a much more threat for the people of Afghanistan.
And how could the U.S. do that?
Well, by stop supporting them, and to just put them on an international trial for the crimes that they have committed. Not just we don't want them to just be removed from the government. We want them to be tried for their crimes that they have committed in Afghanistan. And I think that if they are removed, and if America believes in our common people, in our oppressed people of so many wars that they have gone through, if they trust them, they can very easily, the common people can very easily get rid of the Taliban. And I don't think it's a very serious problem. A more serious problem is right now the same terrorists. They're terrorists. The one in the in the parliament and in the cabinet are terrorists. And there is America looking for them in Pakistan. They should turn to them. They should turn to Northern Alliance, who is right now in power, and see what they're doing in Afghanistan.
Well,
what they have done so far in Afghanistan.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Orbal, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Orbal is a member of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. She's currently visiting the United States. And for more information, you can visit their website at rawa.org, rawa.org. And in the interest of full disclosure, I want to mention that I run an organization here in the U.S. in a volunteer capacity, which supports the work of RAWA. You are listening to Uprising, and later in the hour, we will find out what the LAPD is up to. It plans to train cameras on itself. But first, this week's Empire Notes. Empire Notes are weekly commentaries filed by Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade. Today's commentary is about Obama and Hiroshima.
It's that time of year again. People around the world commemorate the Holocaust of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by folding paper cranes or holding peace vigils. For myself, I write. At times, it's taken considerable ingenuity to connect Hiroshima to the politics of the day. This year, thanks to the Democratic presidential campaign, I could have left the job to a monkey, or even a Fox News host. Last week, Barack Obama made a bellicose speech to the Council on Foreign Relations, in which he tried to defend himself against charges that he wasn't hawkish enough by suggesting that he would radically change policy in the war on terror by his readiness to commit random, meaningless military strikes in Pakistan, much like previous random, meaningless military strikes in Pakistan. Remember the attack on Zawahiri last year that killed over a dozen civilians? A few days later, a reporter asked if he'd be willing to use nuclear weapons against al-Qaeda, and he responded, quote, "I think it would be a profound mistake for us to use nuclear weapons in any circumstance, involving civilians," then followed up by saying, "Let me scratch that. There's been no discussion of nuclear weapons. That's not on the table." Obama, for all his brightness, cleanness, and articulateness, really is unschooled in foreign policy and was clearly unprepared for the question. His initial gut response was the right answer, but he unfortunately worked his way away from it, first by adding the caveat about civilians, and then in a gesture as cowardly as it was futile, attempting to take the entire statement back. Fortunately, a memo from his foreign policy advisor Samantha Power then locked him in, and he has since avowed that initial response. It's sadly symptomatic of a sickness of U.S. politics going way beyond Bush and his creepy cadres that the answer that's obvious to anyone with a particle of sense, that the use of nuclear weapons except perhaps in the last extremity of potential annihilation or subjugation is absolutely immoral, is considered irresponsible and naive by politicians and the foreign policy establishment. Indeed, Obama's almost statement apparently breaches a 40-year tradition that a responsible president should never take the nuclear option off the table even when ordering lunch. Unfortunately, no sooner had Obama's outbreak of sanity occurred than other candidates jumped in to say a good word for insanity. He was attacked by Hillary Clinton, playing up her greater experience in picking spouses, and by Chris Dodd, who apparently is running for president. It does not seem to have bothered them that their statements were on the same moral level as, say, asserting that we retain the option of rounding up small children and killing them. One shouldn't take this too literally. I'm as certain as possible that none of these people would seriously contemplate using nuclear weapons. Indeed, even at the height of chicken littleism about Bush's nuclear fantasies, I never believed that he would. Crossing that international red line would turn the entire world against us. Still, it's amazing to see that apparently the political mainstream has learned almost nothing from the past 7 years. Don't re-elect George W. Bush and don't occupy an Arab country, but that's about it. The Democrats are going to restore our credibility in the world by suggesting that they might drop nuclear bombs on an ally? Look at how ferociously Ahmadinejad of Iran has been excoriated for his ignorant, ridiculous remarks questioning the Nazi Holocaust. Had he also said he didn't want to take the option of killing Jews off the table, perhaps his remarks would have measured up to Clinton's and Dodd's. Please don't keep asking why they hate us. Indeed, even the troglodytic Tom Tan Credo's noises about attacking Mecca and Medina are frankly no more objectionable. This sad inability to view nuclear weapons with the horror they deserve derives fundamentally from the propaganda story about Hiroshima being necessary to save millions of lives. This story conveniently forgets Nagasaki. The fact that the American public remains completely unaware of the actual history and continues to believe this cheap fabrication has and will have reverberating effects on us, the way we act in the world, and the way we are perceived. As Gar Alperovitz says in the most resonant line from his invaluable books on the atomic bombing, quote, "Hiroshima and Nagasaki now, I think, have very little to do with the past. How we choose to deal with them, I believe, may have everything to do with the future." For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Empire Notes is online at www.empirenotes.org. Welcome back to Uprising. Addressing the fallout from this past May's MacArthur Park Immigrants' Rights Rally, Los Angeles Police Chief William Bratton announced that internal camera crews will now film major police actions. Devised by Deputy Chief Mike Hillman, the plan's stated intention is to keep a documented record of policing at major events, while at the same time keeping cops on their best behavior. The move comes in the wake of television camera crews capturing the LAPD's assault on activists, families, and members of the press at last May Day's MacArthur Park Rally for Immigrants' Rights. The footage outraged members of the community and the press, who faced police batons and projectiles. However, members of the media are usually not around to film routine police actions where misconduct can occur. Media outlets rely on individuals who may happen upon an instance of police brutality and have a camera handy nearby. Police actions, both major and minor, are being observed by a much more organized effort thanks to an organization called Copwatch LA. The group patrols the streets of Los Angeles ready to film at any instance of police misconduct. Joining me in studio this morning are two organizers with Copwatch LA, Sherman Austin and Joaquin Cienfuegos. Welcome to Uprising, Sherman and Joaquin.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks very much for joining us. So what was your reaction when you first heard of this LAPD plan that they are going to now monitor themselves, almost like taking over your job?
Huh. Our position is that the police will never police themselves. That's why you need organizations from the community to step up and organize themselves to observe the police and take direct action. The police already have video cameras in their cars, but usually when they brutalize somebody, in the case of Gonzalo Martinez, a 23-year-old or early 20s male who was killed in Downey by the police, and the family has been fighting for 5 years for justice, the police have never turned over the video of them shooting their son. So it goes to show that the police will never police themselves, and that's why Copwatch LA is organizing to stop police brutality and to get rid of that oppressive institution of police in our communities.
So yes, it does seem interesting that even if they did have a camera crew on hand that did film them brutalizing a group, what are the odds that camera footage is actually going to be turned over, particularly if there's some kind of legal trial? Sherman?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in many cases, there have been camera crews present where police have videotaped their own officers brutalizing and harassing people, and we're never going to see that footage. I mean, it's up to the people to go out there and videotape ourselves, because we can't rely on a repressive institution such as the police to police themselves, because it's like saying that, you know, we know we're corrupt, okay, so we're going to investigate ourselves. When the investigation's over, this officer might get a paid leave, a paid vacation, and it'll die down in the media, and before you know it, he'll be back on the streets, which always does happen.
It seems interesting that this news is coming out, or it's being publicized almost as an effort to try to show that they're doing something about what happened on May Day. But at the same time, isn't it possible that the police would at least try to behave better, knowing that there was a video crew nearby?
I think I agree. It's an attempt by the LAPD to attack the growing grassroots revolutionary movement that in our communities, like Copwatch Los Angeles and other organizations that are basically stepping up and saying that, you know, the police are an occupying army and they're not there to protect and serve us. They're there to protect and serve the interests of the rich, the interests of the ruling class, and capitalism and imperialism. So I think that, you know, it is, since it is an attempt to attack these growing grassroots movement, it's also an attempt to act like they're trying to punish or be accountable for what happened on May 1st. In fact, the Chief Braddon and Villaraigosa have come out and blamed the youth, blamed the young anarchists, blamed the people that were there, just speaking out and demanding some justice, demanding some rights for immigrants and undocumented people, right? Mm. So I think that's just a plot to cover up what they did on May 1st.
Now, for you two and Campo Chalet, what would justice look like for what happened on May Day?
We're part of a network called the People's Network in Defense of Human Rights, and we have some demands put out on the table. And some of them include firing Chief Braddon, getting rid of the chief of police that actually Villaraigosa, the mayor, who we also want to see him gone, right?
Specifically of what happened on May 1st.
Because what happened on May 1st and because mm-hmm. of what he's doing in our communities on a daily. Like, he's, you know, all these attacks that are happening in our communities because of these people, right? And the reason is because we see that, you know, Chief Braddon, yes, he's part of the problem. And even though if we have a new chief of police, doesn't guarantee that things will be better. But it's a step in the direction. And Chief Braddon is actually one of the individuals that's responsible for the type of policing we have in our communities. He's one of the main people that's responsible for what happened on May 1st, because he's the one that trains these people, right?
So I'm speaking with Joaquin Cienfuegos and Sherman Austin. We just heard from Joaquin. Sherman, you too may not buy that the, you know, putting video crews in with police is going to be enough to quell police brutality. But do you think that the mainstream in Los Angeles, that, you know, ordinary people may not necessarily be activists, do you think they're going to buy it?
I don't know. It depends. I think that it's definitely an attempt by the LAPD to try and tell your everyday person that there is going to be accountability in the police department now that they have these cameras watching their own officers. But I think that people, you know, everyday people in communities where police brutality is not a rare occurrence already know the fact of the matter that it doesn't matter how many cameras are watching the police that are being videotaped by the police, we're still going to see more brutality, more racism, more criminalization of a generation, and more, you know, basic, you know, harassment and racial profiling in our communities, and it's not going to stop. And I think that you can't really convince, it's gotten to a point where I think you can't really convince people to say that our officers, Chief Batten is saying our officers are going to be videotaped, because people already know that. They already know how the police are, and they already know that, you know, if something happens in their communities where a police is caught brutalizing someone or even killing someone, nothing's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Nothing's going to happen unless some type of real direct action is taken, because nothing ever happens.
So let's talk a little bit about Cop Watch LA in the last few minutes of this interview. You are both organizers with Cop Watch LA. When did this organization start, and specifically what do you go out and do?
We started maybe about a couple years ago. We started having our first meetings, and a lot of what actually sparked up the organization was not only our own experiences with the police, which have all been bad, our own experiences in the prison system and stuff like that. It also started up after the case of Susie Pena, when she was shot in the head with the rifle in Watts by the police, and other cases of police brutality and police murders, like the case of Gonzalo Martinez. And of course, some people out there also might know about the case of DeAndre Bronston, who was unarmed, killed by Compton sheriffs. And so we basically came to the conclusion that, you know, we've gone to City Hall, we've gone to City Council, we've gone to courts, we've filled out police complaint forms. I mean, we've even gone to the police. All that we've seen in response to that is more brutality, more murder, more repression in our communities, and we're sick and tired of it, so we're taking matters back into our own hands. And with that, we're going out and we're organizing in a form of direct action, where we start patrolling the police in our own neighborhoods. Because what else can we do? I mean, we can't ask these people who are within the system to try and hold these officers accountable. We as a people in our own communities need to build power in numbers and power in the movement, and start holding these officers accountable ourselves.
So you basically follow police on their patrols with video cameras? Okay.
Yeah, that's one tactic that I think we see that is necessary for people to not only observe the police, but to confront them. And I think once the police see that people are organized, they actually step back. You know, they're not used to seeing people confronting them. They're used to seeing people being afraid of them.
Now, do you ever get harassed yourself just for following with video camera?
Yeah, actually, I was arrested in a patrol when I was invited by the Long Beach chapter. I was arrested for spitting on the sidewalk because I was patrolling the police. I was observing the police.
For spitting on the sidewalk?
Yeah. So, like, I think, but...
You were arrested? You weren't just ticketed? You were arrested?
I was arrested, and they tried to book me, but the sergeant didn't allow for the police to book me on that charge because it would have, you know, basically fired back in their face, and they didn't want to create a you know, something larger because they had arrested me. So I think there's like political consequences, right? Mm.
So in addition to watching the police yourself, do you get videotape from others who might have happened to catch police brutality or harassment on tape?
Yeah, that's part of our mission, right? And our goal is to support family members that have been victims of police brutality, have been victims of police murder. And we try to support them by popularizing cases of police brutality. And, for example, we had the case of William Cardenas, who was brutalized in Hollywood, was beat by the police, punched in the face, and choked. And one of the neighbors and family had contacted us, and contacted one of our members, and he got us the video, and we put it up on YouTube, and we were able to expose it. So I think that's part of one of the tactics that we use to support family and support our communities of, that are coming under attack. But in terms of Cop Watch, I think that, you know, we're also trying to build people's institutions. We're trying to create the power where people can actually organize themselves and start relying on the police and start relying on themselves.
How can people get a hold of you, and if they're interested in becoming part of your organization, although they have to be worried about being arrested for things like spitting on the sidewalk, but if they're okay with that, how can they get in touch with you and even join your organization if they're interested?
We have a toll-free number. It's 1-877-8-NO-COPS. We also have a website, www.copwatchla.org. And there's a process for membership, and, you know, we can encourage people to organize in their own communities. We want people to create a culture of serving the police and taking direct action.
So when you this 1-877 number, is that also a number that people can call if they have some videotape that they happen to capture police brutality on?
Yeah, they can call us, or they can post it up on their own. They can post it up on their website.
Actually post it on copwatchla.org?
It's a newswire. People can upload video and photos and audio.
Let me give the information again. It's 1-877-8-NO-COPS, and copwatchla.org is the website. Sherman Austin and Joaquin Cienfuegos, thank you both so much for joining me today.
No thank problem. You.
Thanks.
I've been speaking with two organizers with Copwatch LA. They both joined me in studio, and we're talking about LAPD's new tactic or new plan, at least, to train video cameras on themselves during major incidents. It is in response to the May Day debacle that took place this past May. You are listening to Uprising, and for Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I'd like to quote Albert Einstein, who once said, "Every kind of peaceful cooperation among men is primarily based on mutual trust, and only secondarily on institutions such as courts of justice and police." That's Albert Einstein, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Rashi Kesarwani is today's volunteer producer. Tamika Zogi is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, which is linked through kpfk.org. Just click on Programs in the left column. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks for listening.